Most of you probably have kind of a somewhat familiarity with the book. Actually, from just an outsider's perspective, from a secular view, the book of Ruth is a really great story. Okay, listen to these quotes. One author says, "The book of Ruth is one of the most delightfully literary compositions in the ancient world." Okay, he says that it's a great story with strong characters, a plot development, and there's suspense, and there's resolution, and there's teaching. There's lessons like dealing with pain and loyalty and showing kindness and love and all these great teaching points. It's a charming tale. One other author says, "A charming tale of human devotion and kindness. And it's one of the most beautiful in the entire Old Testament, constituting a model of the art of storytelling." Okay, so as we go through, hopefully you'll see these themes and these character developments. In fact, this chapter one, we're going to meet really two of the main characters. And we'll see kind of these themes. And as we go throughout each month, we're going to be looking at the truths that are there. And we're going to pull them out and say, well, how can we apply these to here and now? But there's one big truth that I want to make sure at the outset in terms of, by way of introduction, to say, here's the big point, here's the big theme of the book of Ruth. Okay, so, and here's how we're going to get to the big theme. When you look at, and this is just basic Bible study. So when you're reading the Bible, when you're reading a book in the Old Testament versus a letter in the New Testament, you should ask yourself, okay, how does this relate to the big story of the Bible? So when you read one of Paul's letters, you're going to interpret it differently, knowing it's a letter, but it's after Jesus and Paul's writing to a church. Whereas when we read Ruth or you read Samuel or Judges or Genesis, it's before Christ. And so it's going to be a little harder to pull direct applications to us. So we just intuitively know when we read books, we should ask, okay, well, how does this fit in the big picture? Okay, and so when we think about the big picture of the Bible, the book of Ruth comes between these kind of two bookmarks. And so the book of Judges, if you're familiar with the book of Judges, it was some of the darkest days in the time of Israel. Okay, there's this cycle of judgment where these leaders come and God will raise up a deliverer and things will go well, but then the Israelites will turn, then God will raise up someone to judge them, or an enemy, he'll raise up an enemy to judge them, they'll go into slavery. Then they'll say, well, we're wrong, and cry out again, be delivered. It's just this cycle of God raising up judges and enemies. And the theme at the end of the book of Judges is there was no king in the land, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And that's the refrain, and that's what the author of Judges says. There's no king, and there's chaos. It's anarchy. And this was the result. It's just chaos. People doing whatever they want. There's no order. And so the Judges ends almost like, where's the leadership? Where's the king? Okay, and then on the other side of Ruth, we have, starting in 1 and 2 Samuel, okay, this is the story of Israel's search for a king, and it goes from Saul, but then eventually David's rise and David's rule. He's anointed, and then he rules as king. Okay, so it's the end of Judges, and then 1 and 2 Samuel, here's this journey of Israel and their king, and David, the kind of the monarch of monarchs in the history of Israel. And so in between these two, okay, we'll see in Ruth chapter 1, the very first verse, it says, when the judges ruled, so here's the context, this story takes place when it's the time of the judges. So there's chaos, there's no leader. And what Ruth gives us is, here's David, this great king, but before his story starts, the author of Ruth says, okay, here's the background of David. Here's in this chaotic mess of a nation, when judges are ruling, there's chaos. God is sovereignly, providentially working to bring about, and if you go to the end of Ruth, the very last three verses of the book of Ruth, the point of the author of Ruth is, here's this whole story, and then the last verse is Boaz, who we're going to meet in a couple months. Okay, Boaz fathered Obed, and Obed fathered Jesse, and Jesse fathered David. Okay, so when the author of Ruth is writing, okay, this person knows David is going to be king. This was most likely written after David's gone. Okay, but David, they know he's going to be king. And so when he starts the story, his point is to show, look at how chaotic everything was, but God sustained, God providentially brought about the king that we know as David, the hero of our nation, as he's writing, came from this story. Okay, so it's a fitting place between Judges and 1 and 2 Samuel. Ruth is the connector between these two stories. And so I'd say the main idea is this relationship between God's providence and God's king. Okay, the providential hand of God in the preservation of Israel's royal line during the dark days of the Judges. So even when there's chaos and there's everyone doing what they want to do, everyone doing what's right in his own eyes, God is still preserving this holy line so that at the end of the story, we'll see David comes from this story, from the book of Ruth. So divine providence is the main thing, specifically as it relates to the king, the kingly line, the royal line of David. Okay, so God, I mean, I think for us, big truth, God is able to accomplish his promises. Remember, he had promised to David, you're going to have a son that's going to reign forever. And there's disagreement, but I think it's likely that David's gone by the time this is written. But in this darkness that David's gone, they say, remember the dark time before when God sustained and brought forth David? It's dark now. There's going to be another king coming. And I think this is in order to encourage God's people that he's able to accomplish his promises. All right, so chapter 1, a few other little introductory notes. The author is unknown. It doesn't say in the passage anywhere in the text of the book. A lot of people, there's a school of thought that thinks it's Samuel, but most modern commentators say that that's not likely because, like we just said, at the end, there's a significance of David. And so if Samuel wrote it, Samuel dies before David ascends and becomes king. And so it's probably not Samuel. Okay, so we don't know the author. Another interesting thing, as you look at it, why is it called the Book of Ruth? Okay, when we look at it, Ruth is not a main character. I mean, maybe she's one of the main characters, but in terms of Boaz, probably has more words attributed to him in here. But also, Naomi is the main person right at the beginning. But none of those, it's the Book of Ruth. That's an interesting point because it's the only book in the Bible that's named for a non-Israelite. Okay, Ruth, you're going to see, is a Moabite, okay, which is a really significant thing that we'll draw out. But she's a Moabite. There were a couple others, but I can't remember them. But it's called Ruth, okay? She is, it's called Ruth. Don't know why. All right, time's ticking. So we have four chapters, and there's one word for each chapter as we think about the outline. So chapter one is going to be crisis, okay? We're going to see crisis, especially thinking of this, the royal line, the lineage. Okay, there's going to be a crisis, a problem in chapter 1. Chapter 2, there's going to be hope. Okay, there's going to be a third character introduced that's like, okay, here's hope. Then chapter 3, there's a complication because there's another, there's something, a challenge to this hopeful solution of chapter 2. Crisis, hope, complication, then chapter 4, rescue. All right, so that's how we'll go through each chapter as the summer goes on. But chapter 1, crisis. Crisis. So let me just read chapter 1, if that's okay, if you have your your copies. The ones that I handed out and the ones that I'll be reading from is the English Standard Version, but follow along, and I'll just read the first 22 verses of Ruth chapter 1. In the days when the judges ruled, there was famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab. He and his wife Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of one was Orpah, and the name of the other, Ruth. They lived there about 10 years, and both Mahlon and Chilion died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. Actually, let's stop there. That might be better just to work through section by section. So here's the introduction. Like we said, the days of the judges. Okay, you know the context. So there's chaos in the land. And not only the time of the judges, but there's famine in the land. So this is the setting. The setting is being laid out. So there's famine in the land. Now when we are reading this, when we hear famine in the land, when God's people experience famine, okay, we could say, well, there was probably a drought or there were just some weather issues that were causing that. But there's another side of it that's always held forth, and that's part of God's relationship with his people. Okay, when they were unfaithful or they rebelled or they turned, okay, part of their judgment, one of them was raising up enemies to conquer them, but another one was bringing famine. Okay, famine would have been understood as God's judgment for idolatry and rebellion of God's people. So when you remember that this is in the context of the time of the judges, it's likely that they have rebelled, and so part of God's judgment is there's famine in the land. Okay, so this is God's doing. I think anyone reading this the first time as a Israelite, as a Jewish person, would say, oh, God's judgment was this famine. Okay, and so if that's the judgment, the judgment in light of apostasy or turning away or idolatry, the right response for God's people would be what?
Repent.
Repent, turning back. Okay, so that turn back and I'll heal your land. Okay, this is how the covenant relationship works. Okay, and so that would seem to be the right response for God's people. But here, this man of Bethlehem, okay, and interesting, the word Bethlehem is house of bread. Okay, that's the two words, it's a compound word, it means house of bread. But this man, from this house of bread, there's no bread, there's no food, and his response is to journey into the land of Moab, to sojourn. Okay, so that's not the right response for God's people in light of famine. Okay, so that's the first thing. So I think that this journey, I don't think it's this neutral thing. I think this is wrong. I think it's a sinful response of Elimelech to do this. Okay, so they journey into the land. They leave. Now, to make things worse, not only do they just go anywhere, but they go to the country of Moab. Okay, the Moabites were enemies of enemies of the Israelites. I mean, some of the history, they started back when Lot and had this incestuous relationship with his daughter. That's where they come from. That's like their genesis comes from this relationship. But then after the Exodus, when the Israelites are going through, they try and pass through the land and they say, no, you can't come through. Okay. And then later, I think it's in Numbers 24, 23, the daughters of Moab, I mean, much like is the pattern, but these daughters marry with the Israelites and they're a snare to them. And God is, his anger is kindled against the Israelites for their intermarriage with the Moabites. And these Moabite women specifically are said to be a snare to them. And then in Deuteronomy 23, there's this kind of these laws, this section of laws, and one specific thing, God says the Moabites are excluded from entering the assembly, ever. Them and the Ammonites are these two people groups that God says they cannot enter the assembly. Okay, so seeking refuge in Moab is not a good idea for these Israelites, for this Jewish family. And I mean, a side point, Ruth lives in Moab. Ruth, a common refrain whenever she's referred to throughout this book is Ruth the Moabite. The author doesn't want us to miss, she is a Moabite. So remember, the Moabites and the Israelites, and Ruth is a Moabite. Okay, we'll get to that later, but just realizing that David, also Jesus, had Moabite blood in him. Okay, that says something about God and his plan. But so they go to the Moabites. So they go, Elimelech the husband. So they're going, they were Ephraimites, they're going. Verse 3, but Elimelech the husband died, and she was left with her two sons. So as they venture, okay, they're a full family. It's a father and a wife and two sons. All right, things are going well in their mind. They're going, but quickly Elimelech dies. Okay, when Elimelech dies, okay, Naomi is, I mean, she's in a pretty bad spot, okay, to be without a husband. Okay, the women, they were not protected, but she had her son, so there's hope for her to be cared for there. So she still has her sons, but then it continues. Elimelech the husband died. Then verse 4, so her sons, they take Moabite wives. I mean, the hope is to have a remnant, to have male remnants, so that there could be a care or a perseverance or preservation of the line. Okay, but so they took Moabite wives. Okay, I don't know. I think this is probably a bad thing for them to take Moabite wives. Probably not looked kindly upon or well upon, but they take Moabite wives. This could be kind of like the, you know, Abraham, when he seeks to, with the servant girl, to have a child. This could be, they're like, okay, we gotta have kids. Let's do whatever we can to make it happen. But anyway, so they take Moabite wives. Okay, so there's, they add two more. They live there about 10 years, and both Mahlon and Chilon died. Okay, now it's interesting, the 10-year period, they don't have kids. So you assume that these women are barren. You assume they're trying to have kids. I mean, that's the purpose, but for 10 years, they can't have kids. Now, if this is a sign of God's judgment, I mean, certainly we wouldn't want to say that now if someone, but maybe their rebellion and going to Moab, we don't know. All we know is 10 years they have no children and then the husbands die. Okay, so this once optimistic and full family is now down to the wife and then the two daughter-in-laws. Okay, so that the woman was left without her husband, without her two sons and her husband. Okay, so let's pick up verse 6 and see what happens there. So remember, she went into Moab, things are going well, and within 10 plus years there, I mean, she has nothing, no husband and not no sons. Okay, no male left to her. Verse 6, then she arose with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. So she set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her daughters-in-law, go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband. Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, no, we will return with you to your people. But Naomi said, turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. Then they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. All right, so here, Naomi, things, I mean, it's as bad as it's going to get. Verse 6, she rises and decides to leave Moab. Why does she decide to leave Moab? Why is she leaving in verse 6? Famine is over. Okay, what is that? Famine where? Yeah, she hears. So she's out in the field and it says, she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. Okay, I think that's just, she hears in the field. Is she just in the field one day and someone's like, oh yeah, I heard Israel. Maybe we should go to Israel. How does she hear? She hears that the famine is over, that God had visited his people. Isn't that interesting how she interprets the famine ending? It's not, oh well, the rain came again and it was a good year, so the crop is growing. No, she says, God visited his people. Okay, so she's going back. The famine's over. I was reminded of the prodigal son. Remember when he's eating food in the pigsty and he remembers the food at his father's house. That was just an image that came to my mind. I'm not saying that's a connection there, but it's kind of like, back, we're going home. There's food back home. I'm going home. So Naomi is going home and her daughter-in-laws rise and go with her. So on their way, verse 7, quickly, or verse 8, Naomi says, go, return each of you to her mother's house. Okay, Naomi quickly says, don't come with me. Don't come with me. Now, why would she say, don't come? Well, she gives a couple reasons. One of them is the Moabites. I think Naomi understands that Moabites returning to Judah with her won't go well for her, but it definitely won't go well for them. Okay, so it's for their own good. Don't come with me. You don't know. I came here as an alien. I was not a Moabite. I came here, and maybe there's some difficulties for her. But for them to go back without husbands, without anything, with just a mother-in-law, I think she's afraid for them. But more significantly for her, she's saying, you don't have any prospect or any future if you come back with me. And look at how her point, so they refuse first. So verse 10, they say, no, we're going to return with you to your people. But then verse 11, okay, she emphasizes this whole son thing. Notice she says, why are you going to go with me? I don't have any more sons. Okay, I had two, okay, but they're gone and I don't have any more. My husband's gone. I don't have any more sons. And I'm old, okay? I'm not going to get married anytime soon. No more sons are coming, girls, right? No more sons are coming. But then, even if I did get married, okay, let's say tonight I get married. Would you wait for them to grow up? Okay, we're talking years. There's no prospect, but even if it happened tonight, would you wait? I mean, her point is, there's no hope. Basically, if you come with me, you are giving up on marriage and a future or a life or hope. Okay, so this is a point, and this is going to be one of the discussion questions. In Naomi's mind, the only hope for these two young women is remarriage and children and a lineage. Do you see that? There's no hope for you. No chance. You come with me and it's over, because in her mind, the only chance or only hope for them was children, marriage and children. Okay? So that's we're going to ask a question about that. I mean, I say that that's a limited perspective on hope in life, to say, well, this is it. Unless you have this, you don't have it. But in Naomi's mind, there's no hope for them if they follow her back. And so Orpah, one of the daughters, makes the sensible choice and goes back home. Okay, mother-in-law, you convinced me. I tried to stay, but I'm not gonna stay longer. Okay, you're right. You make some good points. So Orpah goes, but verse 14, but Ruth clung to her. Okay, so Ruth refusing to go. We'll pick up verse 15. Naomi says to Ruth, as Ruth is clinging to her, refusing to listen, she says, "See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, and this is probably one of the most famous couple verses in the book of Ruth. Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts me from you." And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. So here's Ruth. I mean, this language here, it's almost a marital language. It's a covenantal, it's a commitment. It's like each level is ratcheting up her commitment. It's not like, okay, I'm going to relocate. I can find a job there. This is everything. It's as if Ruth is saying, "I am all in." Okay, and not only does this have implications for relationship between Ruth and Naomi, but this has huge religious implications. Ruth, in these verses, is putting herself under the rule and government of Naomi's God. She is saying, "I am deciding to be ruled by your God." I mean, even when she says, "I will be buried there." Okay, being buried in a foreign land was a big deal. I mean, there were territorial gods. And so for her to say, "I'm going to be buried where your God rules." I mean, this is an all-in covenantal. Ruth is saying, "I'm committed not only to you, Naomi, but to your God and his people." Most commentators, and I think I agree, would, if you were to say this was the conversion of Ruth, this was Ruth saying, "I am deciding to follow the God of Israel." Okay, and I think this is where you would say, because of all that she left, and she said, come, whatever, okay, I'm following you no matter what. I am following you and your God. Now, verse 19, or the end of verse 18, when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. Now, I don't know how to interpret this, okay, but it's hard to tell if this is Naomi. I mean, maybe you guys have had an argument, maybe some of you spouses, right? There's this silence. Okay, you're stubborn. I'm not saying anything else, right? I tend to think that this is what's going on. I think Naomi's saying, "Fine. You're going to learn, right? You're going to see how bad this is for you. I'm not saying anything else. Come on." So, and again, there's no clear indication, but I think that Naomi is not positively affected by her daughter-in-law's commitment to her. Okay, I don't think she's like, "Oh, thank you. Yes, let's go." I think she's harsh in this response. She says no more. Okay, and so they continue back to Bethlehem. And here's why I think Naomi is in a bad place. We'll use that word. She's in a bad place. Because when they get back, okay, the whole town was stirred. And look at how this one commentator pointed this out. So in verse 19, so the two of them, okay, this is plural, the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, okay, so this whole pattern is they, two of them doing it. But when they get back to town, the women say, they don't say, well, who is that Naomi and who is that? Who are the women? No, they only say, is this Naomi? No recognition. It seems to say immediately she's not even recognized. Ruth as, oh, well, that's a Moabite. What's Naomi? We don't care about the other one. But they say, is this Naomi? And look at how Naomi interprets what has just happened to her. Okay, she gives a commentary on her life. Okay, they say, well, is this Naomi? Maybe she has more gray hairs. Maybe she's been worn by... I mean, we shouldn't belittle what's happened to her in this short matter of time. Her husband and her two sons. I mean, that's significant loss, suffering. So she goes back. She's probably worn out from it. So they say, is this Naomi? And she says, verse 20, do not call me Naomi. Okay, probably has a footnote that says pleasant. Okay, so whatever the word Naomi implication is, pleasant or delightful. She says, don't call me that. Instead, call me Mara. Okay, the footnote there would say bitter. Call me bitter. Don't call me pleasant. Call me bitter. Here's why. For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. Okay, so this is a negative view of what's happened. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me? So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, again, Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law with her, who returned from the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. Now look at her commentary on what's just happened. So starting in verse 20, actually verse 21, No, 20. Start in verse 20. So look at the words, how she describes what's happened. Okay, she says, don't call me Naomi, instead call me Mara. For, okay, now think of what's happened. We said she lost her husband and she lost her two sons. Okay, so this is extreme suffering, great loss. She truly has come back empty. What she says, here's why you're to call me Mara. The Almighty has dealt bitterly with me. Okay? The Almighty has dealt bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me? Okay, so what is the cause? How does Naomi interpret what's just happened to her in Moab? Who is the source of this suffering? Who does she attribute as dealing bitterly with her? The Almighty, God. So she lost everything. How did she lose it? We'd say death, okay? The death of her sons and her husband. So if I ask, well, what was the cause of death? I mean, what caused them to die? It's not like, well, my husband got sick with this disease. My sons, they were out fighting for something or they were hunting. They got killed. No, she says that those things could have happened. But she says, ultimately, the Lord, God has done this. God has done this. And so Naomi, this truth, and I'm going to say this is true. This is a truth, but this truth for her makes her bitter. Okay, she says that God has dealt bitterly with me. So she gets it right that God has done it, but her response is bitterness. Now I'm going to say that's wrong. Okay, Naomi seems to see all this suffering as God's doing. Okay, and I'd say yes, that's true. But she sees it as a bitter dealing. Okay, she sees what's just happened with eyes of only God is dealing harshly with me. His hand has gone out against me. Okay, it's not good. My suffering is made me bitter. Okay, and so as the story progresses, okay, we're going to see that, in fact, this is God's doing, but this is a far cry from a bitter dealing. This is not God dealing bitterly with her. Okay, in the immediate context, yes, this is hard, but I think the author of Ruth, and I think Naomi at the end of the story, would say God's hand was providentially at work in every circumstance in Moab and in Bethlehem. Okay, God's providential hand was in control. I think she will realize how wrongly she interpreted God's dealings with her. Okay, it wasn't a bitter dealing, but it was a great, gracious dealing with her. Okay, so am I at 30 minutes? I'm done. Okay, and here's the questions that I want us to think, because I think this is a good question to consider. I will make one final note. When they return, and this is just good things to note to look for when you're reading. But remember where the story started in chapter 1? Where were they? They're in Bethlehem. What was the situation in Bethlehem? Famine. Okay, they go to Moab. The end of chapter 1, where does it end? They come full circle. They're back in Bethlehem, but it's not famine anymore. The last verse of chapter 1, the beginning of the barley harvest. Okay, so they've come full circle. So there's kind of a hint of things to come.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. It's being brought to you by Bacon's Castle Baptist Church. And if you'd like more information about our church, please visit us on the web at www.baconscastle.com.